Well, welcome everybody. My name is Sebo Asanya. I'm the Bishop of Museum Chair in Modern Armenian History here at UCLA, for those of you who may not know this. And I'm really grateful that you've shown up tonight to hear our guest lecturer, Nancy Kikorian. Before I introduce her, let me say a few words about the lecture series that we've organized for this quarter, leading up to the April 24th centennial commemorations. We have a number of visitors coming up still. We've had already four or five in the past, addressing themes related to the Armenian Genocide, and we still have three or four lectures ahead of us, leading up to a conference that we're also hosting here entitled Genocide in Global History, that will be convened here at UCLA on the 10th of April and the 10th and 11th of April. So, for those of you who are not aware of this and want to follow these events, you can go to this website here online. This is the official website for the chair, modernarmeniahistory.historyucla.edu, and here you will see in the events section all the upcoming talks. And very quickly, we still have a very interesting talk by Rachel Goshkarian on March the 11th, entitled Ottoman Displacements, Geographies and Spatialities in the World of 17th Century Armenian Authors from Kefe, followed by a talk by Stepan Asturian, or actually preceded by a talk by Stepan Asturian on March the 5th on the historiography of the Armenian Genocide. And all of this is a prelude to the April 10th, 11th conference here, which is an international conference, a two-day conference, featuring some of the best scholars in genocide studies, Holocaust studies, who will be here for 2 days and will participate in back-to-back panels on the 10th and 11th, including an evening of keynote lectures by three distinguished scholars of the genocide or personalities who've dealt with the genocide, including our very own Professor Richard Ovanisyan, who is here tonight with us, and whose chair, and whose name is on the chair that I currently hold. So that is the keynote address evening is at Schoenberg Hall on the 9th of April the 10th from 7 to 10 p.m. It'll be all available on this website as well as being publicly disseminated through press release and flyers. For those who do not receive these flyers, please contact Mary Momjan in the back and give her your email, and you will be receiving regular updates regarding the upcoming talks. So, coming to today's speaker, Nancy Kikorian is the author of numerous novels, including Zabel, Dreams of Bread and Fire, and most recently, All the Life There Was, which will be the topic of today's lecture. She's a very talented writer, novelist, as well as activist, who's worked on a number of causes, and I know Nancy mostly because most recently, actually, through our work together on an NGO called Project 2015, which seeks to take diaspora Armenian members to Istanbul on the 24th of April to commemorate the Armenian Genocide in the very city where it was planned and executed. So, Nancy grew up in Massachusetts, in Watertown to be more precise. She earned her undergraduate degree in comparative literature at Dartmouth College. She spent the following year studying semiotics at the University of Paris, after which she completed a Master's of Fine Arts degree in poetry at Columbia University. She's taught at Bernard College, Rutgers, Queens, and Yale, and since 2003 has been on the staff of Code Pink, Women for Peace, which is an activist organization with tentacles across North America at the very least. She lives in New York City, and I'm very, very honored to have her tonight for that speaker. Thank you very much.
Now, Do you want this to be on floor mode or
yeah.
is this the way it is?
Okay. I'm going to go back to the beginning. Okay. Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sabu, for the invitation. I'm also just excited to be here because it's been the most miserable winter in New York possible in 3 days, and this really nice weather has been a great opportunity to be warm. So I'm going to talk tonight about my third novel, which is called All the Light There Was. It's about Armenians in Paris during the Nazi occupation. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got to writing this book and then the research that went into it. It's my third novel, and I'm working on my fourth, and all of the books are focused on post-genocide Armenian diaspora communities. And I would say that the inspiration for my first novel, Zabel, was my grandmother, Mariam Kojibabian, and this is a photo of her with her family in Mersin, Cilicia, Ottoman Empire, circa 1910. She and her family were deported in 1915, and of her immediate family, only she and her brother were in this photo, were the ones who survived, and they were among 8,000 orphans in a sort of refugee camp at Ras El Ain in the Syrian desert. And there she is in our backyard now, Mary Krikorian, in our backyard in Watertown, circa 1910, rocking the hula hoop. And she was a very important character in my life. And after she died, I was inspired by her story and the stories of some of the other women who were genocide survivors in our church to write this first novel, which was a fictionalized account of my grandmother's life as an Armenian genocide survivor and immigrant bride. My next novel, Dreams of Red and Fire, is about someone of my generation growing up under the shadow of this mass trauma, unspoken mass trauma, and then as a young adult, learning about it and coming to terms with it. One of the characters in the book is a Marxist-Leninist, an Armenian Marxist-Leninist revolutionary who sets off a bomb outside a Turkish Airlines office. And so when I was doing research for that character, I read voluminously. I mean, this is the way I always work, is I do a ton of research, and only a small fraction of that actually ends up in the book. But I felt like, you know, to create this character, I had to understand how he thought and understand his world. So I was reading about all kinds of revolutionary groups, different groups that use violence, you know, ranging from the Weather Underground to the Red Army Brigade to the Symbionese Liberation Army to the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And when I was doing this research, I came across a story that I had never heard before. I came across a documentary, a French documentary, that was called Terrorists in Retirement. And it was a 1984 French documentary that told the story of a French communist resistance network that was made up of immigrant workers. And the network's leader was an Armenian poet named Misak Manouchian. So in late 1943, the Germans arrested Manouchian and 22 members of his group. And this is a mugshot of Manouchian after he was arrested. Here's a photo of him. He was actually an Armenian genocide survivor himself. He was born in 1906 in Adıyaman in the Ottoman Empire. And this photo is from the early 1920s in an orphanage in Junia, Lebanon. And he's the orphan child who's in the third row, third from right, with a cross on his clothing. This one right here. Manouchian and his brother, who were the only surviving members of his immediate family, went to Marseille in 1925, And then his brother died in Marseille, I believe it was from tuberculosis, and then Mnuchin himself made his way north to Paris. And he ended up working at a factory in Paris, and then it was from then he ended up, you know, getting organizing this network, communist resistance network. And here is a photo of them that was in the collaborationist papers at the time, and it says 23 terrorists were condemned to death by the German court martial. And the Mnuchin group, as it was called, is credited with the assassination on the 28th of September 1943 of German General Julius Ritter, who was actually a personal friend of Hitler's, who was in Paris at the time. And they carried out, the Mnuchin network carried out almost 30 successful attacks on German interests from August to November of 1943, and when they were arrested. And then they had a propaganda show trial, and they were executed in February of 1944. And after they were executed, these signs were put up all around Paris. And it says, "Liberators, liberation by the army of crime." And the idea was that all of these guys looked, you know, just sort of like tough-looking mugshots in these medallion photos, and all their names are on there, and they're sort of supposed to be, the Germans are saying, "Well, these are sort of terrorists, immigrants with crazy names that you can't pronounce, are the people who are calling themselves the resistance, and they're actually, you know, criminals." And the bottom shows photos of their weapons and then results of the attacks that they carried out. But what happened was, when they put this poster around, it was a few days after the execution, they put the posters all around the walls of Paris, and people at night after curfew scrawled across them, you know, dead for France, mort pour la France, and then they put flowers at the foot of the wall where the posters were hung, so it didn't have the propaganda effect that the Germans had hoped. So I was completely fascinated by this story, this chapter in Armenian history, this chapter in the history of the French resistance, but I didn't want to write a novel about Dmytsak Mnuchin. I just started thinking about what would it have been like for Armenian genocide survivors who had made their way to France and rebuilt their communities and, you know, looked out the window and saw German troops marching down the street. So I had an idea that I wanted to do it in the working class French community of Belleville, which at the time was sort of Belleville is still there, but at the time it was full of immigrants, Eastern European Jews, Armenians, Greeks, and the Armenians and the Greeks were very big in the shoe trade at the time. So I went to Paris, and I think it was like 2003, I went on the first trip to start interviewing people, and I had the good fortune, you know, I don't know, for people who are Armenian, you know how this works, I had one friend in Paris, and I asked him, I told him what I was looking for, and he found all the people for me. And this, Arsene Chakarian, he's holding my book, Gabel, which I brought him a copy of, and I went to his house and met him, and that's his wife, Jacqueline. And he is one of the last surviving members of the Mnuchin group, and he has devoted his life to documenting the work and the lives of his friend Dmytsak Mnuchin and other members of the French resistance who were executed by the Nazis at Montpellier, which was a prison on an execution spot outside of Paris. So I met with him to get his story. One of my favorite parts of doing, I love doing research, but one of my favorite parts is actually doing the oral history where you interview people and get people to tell you their stories. And I always feel, I probably have the way that my mind works, but I always feel as though I'm putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And through the different books that I read and the narratives, the stories that I get from different people, I feel like I'm putting together a sort of jigsaw puzzle picture of the time and the place. One of the other people that I met was Nazareth Pashtikian, who is, unfortunately, he's no longer alive. When I met him, he was, I think, 93 years old in 2003. He was also an Armenian genocide survivor, a cobbler, an actor, and as he said, a humanist. During the war, his resistance work entailed delivering clandestine letters and putting anti-Nazi tracts in mailboxes. In 1943, he told me the Americans had bombed the 15th arrondissement of Paris where he was living, and his home was destroyed. His rabbit hutch was upended, that, you know, it was in the courtyard, the building's courtyard, but the rabbits survived. His wife, however, was wounded and transported to the hospital where she died. He repeated this story several times to me. And he also pulled out all his identification cards, the Nansen passport that he had, which was this passport that Armenian refugees were given, you know, because they were stateless people. And so stateless people post-World War I were given these Nansen passports. And a lot of Armenians in France had those passports. Another story that I sort of came across while I was there, which I did not meet Charles Aznavour, but I read his sister's memoir and also his memoir, which told the story of a couple of the chapters talked about what was going on in their family during the war years. And his parents were actually friends with Misak Manouchian and Manouchian's wife Meline. They were quite close friends with them, and they were also communists. And there was a fantastic story that was in both of the memoirs, which was about towards the end of the occupation, in like 43, there were some Armenians who had been in POW camps in Poland, been captured by the Nazis. They had been in the Soviet Army. And they were in these POW camps where they were basically being starved to death. An Armenian nationalist general showed up in the camp and said to them, "We don't know how this war is going to end. We don't know what's going to happen. We're going to need you in Armenia when the war is over here. Put on this German uniform." So there were actually Armenians who were in the Wehrmacht. And they didn't trust, the Germans didn't trust to send them to be on the Eastern Front because they thought they would just run home to Yerevan or wherever it was they came from. So they sent them to France and had them working along the Atlantic coast on the wall that they were building, you know, to prevent the Allied invasion. And so what happened was when those Armenians who were in the German army had leave, they would come to Paris for a few days off. And the Aznavours, there would become patriotic evenings where they would have, meet the Armenians in Paris, and then the Aznavours would invite some of these guys over to dinner and try to convince them to desert the German army and join the resistance. And the ones who did, it was Charles Aznavour's job. He was probably 18 or so years old at the time. They would take off their uniforms, put on civilian clothes, and sort of go underground. And Charles would take the uniforms and the boots out after curfew and throw them into the sewers of Paris. So I thought that was I loved that story, really great story. That piece of it, you know, this Aznavour didn't end up getting into the novel, but I do have a character in the book who is an Armenian in a German uniform who shows up in Paris. And as I said, I was interested in writing about the sort of working class Armenians in Belleville, and I went to, most of the Armenians who've been to Paris would know there's a wonderful Oriental bookstore that's run by an Armenian family, and it's been there since the 20s, called the Librairie Samuelian. And I went in there and talked to the owners about what I was working on, and the woman who is the co-owner of the store said, "Oh, I have a book for you. It's out of print. I have one copy. I will give it to you." And this was the book. And it was by Clément Lepidis, who was, his father was a Greek immigrant who ran a shoemaking atelier in Belleville. But the book is called The Armenian, and it's actually about an Armenian genocide survivor who comes to Paris, comes through Marseille, comes to Paris, and works as a shoemaker in Belleville. And part of this thing where I'm describing the putting together a sort of jigsaw puzzle when I'm working on a novel is I really feel like I have to make in my head the entire atmosphere. I have to know what it smelled like, what people were wearing, what the streets looked like. I look at maps and I look at photographs and I read books. And this one was really wonderful because it was set in the late 20s through the late, the mid-40s, you know, so it was after the war, in this milieu with this Armenian main character. And you feel like when I was reading it, I could hear the sound of the hammers that they were using to make the shoes, and you could almost smell the glue. When I was talking about looking at photos, so I really wanted to know, well, what did it look like in Delville where the character was living? And this is actually a photo that was taken in 1944 by a French photographer named André Zucca, who worked for a Nazi German propaganda magazine called Signal. And because he was working for this propaganda magazine, he was given access to Agfa color film, which was very rare at the time. And he took these very beautiful photos of all the different arrondissements of Paris. He was arrested after liberation, but he was never prosecuted, and he worked until his death in 1976 under an assumed name. But I love this photo because you really get a sense of what, you know, what people were wearing, what the street looked like, and our character, the main character in the book, the narrator, is, she's at the beginning of the book, she's 14 years old, and she lives probably two blocks up and one block, you know, to the right as you're walking up the street. And this was her trajectory, you know, going to school every day, was walking down the route of Belleville. And then here I had to make a, because I had a terrible sense of direction, and I had to be able to visualize in my head where everything is. So I found this map, and then I marked it with, you know, where the things are. So you can see where Belleville is. I'll come over here. This is, this circle right here is sort of central Paris, and Belleville is right here, which is where the 11th, the 12th, the 19th, and the 20th arrondissements meet. That was that's Belleville. And then they have, the characters have some cousins who live out in Alfortville. There was an Armenian community already in Alfortville from the church was built there in the 30s. Then Ici Nemunino, there was also an Armenian community there. Then Pren is where the prison was. This was the prison that Misak Manouchian and the guys in his network were taken, and also two characters in the book end up there. And then from Pren, the characters are sent to Drancy, and then from here going out east to concentration camps. And Drancy was also when they had the roundup, the terrible, that was the roundup of Jews in Paris. The summer of 42, Drancy was where everyone was taken. It was sort of a transit camp, and people went where they were sent to the concentration camps in the east. So that sort of gives you an idea of, you know, where everything happens in the book. The characters, these cousins out in Alphaville actually have a big backyard, and the father ends up raising chickens and ends up being called the Chicken King, because during the war people were so hungry. You know, if you had a chicken coop in your backyard and you had chickens and you had eggs, you could actually make a lot of money. And so our character Mara and her brother ride their bikes out to Alphaville several times to get food. Speaking of food, this is actually a photo of a ration card for bread. During World War II, food was rationed in France. People were issued ration tickets for bread, vegetables, meat, milk, and wine. There were also ration tickets for non-food items like tobacco and fabric. Often, however, even if you had the tickets, the food items were not available in the market shop. I wanted to make one comment about the thing about having ration tickets for fabric. One of the sort of horrible notes about that was that when, in 42, the Jews were required to start wearing the yellow star, they had to use their ration tickets for fabric to purchase the yellow fabric out of which they made the stars. So you would get into the market and you would have the ration ticket, but a lot of times what it was you were looking for wasn't even on the shelf, or it would be like some kind of fake, you know, ersatz attempt at being, you know, the food you were supposed to get. For example, the jam, it wasn't really jam. It was made after they made the wine, the grapes that were left at the end, the sort of sticky mess, that was what the jam would be. So the German war machine was using France as a bread basket. One of the nicknames local Parisians called the occupiers were the Dolphy Faux, which means potato bugs, because most of France's potatoes were shipped off to Germany, as was the butter and the cheese and all this. And here's a photo of a line outside a place where you get butter, eggs, and cheese, and women would stand in line for hours and hours, and then sometimes by the time you got in there, what you were looking for was already gone. So that was what I ended up feeling as I was doing this research was the emphasis was on like how people were hungry, it was a cold time, it was a dark time, and people ended up, unless you had relatives in the countryside, you had a farm, or if you were wealthy or a collaborator, you were very hungry, and a lot of people were living on rutabagas and kinds of root vegetables that had before the war been what they used to feed the cattle. So at one point, the character Madal says that her family is suffering from rutabaga-itis. So one of the things that happens when I'm working on a book is that every day I was spending several hours in Paris with these characters, and I felt like everybody was hungry. They didn't have any soap. They didn't have any, they didn't have any meat. They were suffering from the cold all the time. And without even really realizing what I was doing, at one point my husband opened up the pantry and said, "Why do we have like 8 jars of French mustard?" And when I went in, I looked and it was like I had 8 jars of French mustard. I had like all these liters of olive oil. And like without even really thinking about it, I had started stockpiling food. And then I went into the bathroom and I opened up the vanity and there was like this huge stack of scented soap that I had like not even been aware I was doing it. But I had bought all the stuff and it was sort of like in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, if a war happened here, we'd have plenty of mustard and we'd have plenty of jam and we'll have plenty of soap, like all the things that my characters were lacking. So it was very funny because, so then I finished with that book, the book was published and I had already, before it was even published, I was already started to do research on my next book, which is going to be the fourth in what my editor is calling the Armenian Diaspora Quartet. And it's about Armenians in Borjamud. And my husband said, you're going to like start like collecting shell casings or something? Like what is going to be happening, through the research for this one? I went and made my first research trip to Borjamud. And it's, yet again, I'm feeling like I'm having to build the place in my head. I went and I visited. I've been doing all this reading about the history. Here's a photo of what Borjamud looked like in the 30s. And it was a sort of swampy area out north of Beirut that was ended up getting given to the Armenian, sold to and given to Armenian refugees, most of them from Cilicia, which is where my grandparents were from. My grandparents were from Adana and Mersin. And the Armenians came here and organized, grouped themselves again by where they came from. So the Armenians from Adana here in Borjamud built Nor Adana or New Adana. The Armenians from Hajin built Nor Hajin and so on and rebuilt their Nor Galigia, Nor Marash, and they rebuilt their communities here in Borjamud. And there was this incredible that generation of rebuilding their lives and then their children growing up in Beirut during a time when Beirut was really very welcoming to them, and they ended up establishing by the mid-60s there were all these Armenian literary magazines and theaters and schools, and it was really a sort of thriving community. And then in 75 the Lebanese Civil War broke out. So this is a photo of Borjamud from 1978 after a particularly intense period where this part of town was being shelled. So I think part of my interest in doing this, the way that I got onto the idea of Borjamud was when I was in Paris doing all the research and meeting all the Armenians who had lived through the war years. My friend, who was my fixer, was an Armenian from Borjamud. And I met all of his friends, some of whom had been folk musicians, my friend himself had been a playwright. I'm trying to remember what the other people did, one of them was a museum curator. And they were all talking, one night we had dinner, and they were all talking about the heyday in the early 70s, when they were all doing these things that they wanted to do, and then they all ended up again sort of as refugees in France, having to rebuild their lives. None of them quite able to be doing what it was that they had thought that they would be doing. So I was thinking really about this way with Armenians, where it's a multiple generations, multiple calamities, but how is there like birds constantly rebuilding, flying someplace new and rebuilding nests? And that's what I'm really interested in the work that I do, is not so much the genocide, but actually post-genocide diaspora experience and this sort of incredible resilience of Armenians continuing to rebuild their communities and rebuild their lives. So what I'm going to do now is read just a little bit from the novel, and then I can take questions. And then what I do to finish, one of my favorite things, I'm really a huge collector of and fan of Armenian proverbs, and after I do the Q&A, I always like to just read a little list of Armenian proverbs as a kind of way to close. So I'm just going to read just the opening chapter of the book. It's like 5 pages. It's not very long. Just so that you get a sense of the atmosphere and the characters. By the time my brother and I arrived at Donabedian's market, our mother was waiting on the sidewalk outside the shop, having commandeered the grocer's wooden hand cart, which was loaded with gunny sacks of bulgur, net bags of onions, liter tins of olive oil, along with miscellaneous brown paper parcels tied with string. From behind the plate glass window, Baron Donabedian waved to us as he and his assistant were busily ringing up sales. Half the neighborhood's housewives had joined the effort to empty his shelves. Misak, my mother said, you and your sister, take this cart home. I have more errands to run. Madal, help your brother carry everything up the stairs. My brother asked, what's all this? My mother said, food. Right, he answered. Are we starting a restaurant? Don't be smart. She tugged at the sacks on the bottom, checking the pyramid of goods was securely settled on the cart. How did you pay, I asked. She shrugged. The money in the cracker tin. My brother and I exchanged glances. For as long as I could remember, at the end of each week, my mother had climbed the step stool in our tiny kitchen to put coins and small bills into the gold and red cracker tin on the top shelf of the cupboard. She was saving to buy an electric sewing machine that would replace the ancient and venerable Singer pedal machine she used to do piecework as a vest maker. She had a newspaper advertisement showing the different electric models, one with an elegant sewing table, one mounted on extravagant marble, and the one she had set her heart on, which was a simple black model on wood that came in a leather carrying case. She coveted the small electric light affixed to the body of the machine. My mother said briskly, after you take everything upstairs, Misak, you return the cart to Donabedian as soon as possible. Madal, put the spices in the jars and the sugar on the top shelf. The rest goes wherever you can, and Auntie Shaki can find space. That was how our war began. It didn't start with blaring newspaper headlines announcing a pending invasion, nor was it signaled by the drone of warplanes overhead. Our war commenced that afternoon when my mother stockpiled groceries so that no matter what this new war might bring, her family would have something to eat. As the trickle of people fleeing Paris turned into a torrent, my father decided we would remain in our apartment in Belleville, an eastern district that at the time still retained some of its character as an outlying village. Schools across the city were closed, and at the order of the authorities, children were being bused out of town to safety. Many stores were shuttered, and their owners loaded cars and streamed toward the peripheral exits. My father wagered, however, that remaining where we had a roof over our heads and where we could keep an eye on his cobbler's shop was safer than wandering across the countryside to God knows where. As he said, we're staying put. The last exodus we saw led straight to hell. That afternoon, Misak and I pushed the handcart up the hill on the sidewalk past our neighbors, the French from the Auvergne and other rural provinces, along with Armenians, Greeks, and Eastern European Jews who had flocked to France for its promised liberties, and all of them looking for employment in Belleville's factories, shoemaking atelier, and tailoring workshops. We wended our way through half a dozen languages with street vendors and their customers engaged in commerce at the end of the workday. As the war moved ever closer, most of the residents of Belleville chose not to join the mass flight from the city. My brother and I made a number of trips up the five flights to our apartment where we deposited the provisions at Auntie Shake's feet. She stood in our front hall wringing her hands. While Misak went to return the hand truck, I climbed on a stool to put the sugar on the top shelf as my mother had instructed. Next, my aunt and I dragged the sacks of Bulgur from the front hall to the bedroom that we shared. With much effort, we wedged two of them under my bed and the other two under hers. That's a lot of Bulgur. My aunt wiped perspiration from her face with a hanky. Enough to laugh until we won't be able to stand the sight of it on our plates, I said. Don't talk like that, Morel. We will be grateful for every bite. My aunt's tone was uncharacteristically severe. Misak stumbled back in, panting under the weight of more packages, having made his final trip up the stairs with my mother at his heels. My father arrived just behind her. Do you feel better now? My father asked my mother. She nodded. I found some more rice and I bought machine needles, hand needles, and 3 dozen spools of thread. But I know there's something I've forgotten. The animals, my brother said. What animals? My mother asked. You know, the pairs of animals, 2 by 2. My mother dismissed him with a toss of her hand. Talk to me in 2 months, Mr. Wise Guy. That night, my mattress, which usually dipped in the middle, hit up against the hard bulk under my bed. I turned from side to side, trying to find a position that felt less as though I were lying on top of a boulder. I slept fitfully, waking a number of times in the night, worrying about the sacks of Bulgur that seemed in the dark as sinister as carcasses. Sometime toward morning, I dreamed that I was standing over a cooking pot someone had left on the stove in the kitchen. I watched a bubbling lamb and tomato stew that rose and rose until, to my horror, it overflowed the pot and, like scalding lava, spread over the kitchen floor. 10 days later, when the Germans marched down the Rue de Belleville, Misak and I watched through the slats of the closed blinds of the Kacharian's apartment on the third floor of a building 2 blocks from ours. Misak, his best friend Zavin, Zavin's brother Barkev, and I were crowded around one window, while Mr. and Mrs. Kacharian with 10-year-old Virginie between them were at the other. As the first tank rolled down the hill, none of us breathed. The tanks were followed by armored trucks, and behind the trucks came tall German soldiers in black uniforms, their boot heels hammering the cobblestones in cadence. When Zavin leaned toward the window for a better view, his shoulder pressed against mine. I had never been so near to him before. I glanced at him sideways, so close that I could see the beads of perspiration on his temple. I stayed perfectly still, prolonging the contact between us and wondering if he felt what I did. When I noticed that his older brother Barkev was staring at me, I was ashamed. I quickly turned to peer through the slats at the columns of troops. Suddenly, Virginie exclaimed, "How handsome they are!" Her father, who never raised a hand to his children, unthinkingly slapped her face. "Handsome? They are the angels of death." At dinner that evening, my mother said, "You have no consideration for anyone else. How do you think we felt when we realized you were gone?" My brother said, "We only went 2 blocks." "Only 2 blocks? You could go 2 steps at a time like this and have disaster fall on you," my mother said. "I know you think you're a grown man because you have a few wisps to shave, but let me remind you that you are 16 years old and your sister is younger." My brother rolled his eyes. "And it's done?" Auntie Shake asked. "Not a shot fired," my father answered. "Paris is an open city. I couldn't see the Germans from the shop, but I heard the boots. That's a sound you'll never forget." And the sound of those boots reverberated in my head for months, and then for years, and sometimes even still. This is the story of how we lived the war, and how I found my husband. So, I can take some questions, but here's my little joke, which is, when I have done my book tours, the Armenians in the audience often ask me these questions, so to preempt them, I just gave the answers. So the first one says, "I'm half Armenian." The second one says, "My husband's not Armenian, he's Jewish." And the third one says, "I speak a little Armenian." And the fourth one says, "I know how to make churegs." And there's a photo of the churegs. So now I can answer other questions, because you know those, the answers to those already.
I know.
So does anybody have any questions?
What's your next project?
The next project is what I was talking about, which is Armenians in Beirut in Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War. Yeah.
When you wrote Zava, did you think that you were going to sort of proceed forward to what your editor called the Armenian?
To ask for a quartet? Yeah.
Did you have any idea at that point?
No. But they kind of came, when I was working at Zabel, I had the idea for Dreams of Bread and Fire, and when I was working on Dreams of Bread and Fire, I had the idea for All the Light There Was, and when I was doing the research for All the Light There Was, and I met all those Armenians from Beirut and Paris, I already started thinking, I'm going to do the next one about Armenians. I don't know what I'll do. The quartet, when it's done, you know, I'm a very slow writer. It's taken me between 5 and 10 years for each of the books. So who knows how long this one is going to take. And I don't know what I don't know yet what I'm going to do after that. I'm still too early in, you know, that's the fourth one. So, yeah.
This is more of a writerly question than a historical one.
Yeah.
When you're doing research for a historical novel, there's all kinds of stuff you need to know to build the world inside your head that enables you to write it.
Right.
But then there's what your readers need to know, which may be somewhat less.
Yeah.
How do you figure out what belongs in your own head for the purposes of world building so that you can write it, and what to shoehorn into the book?
Yeah, that was always really hard.
I fail and fail and fail at that.
Yeah. Well, what happened was the first draft of All the Light There was horrible. Like, it was terrible. It was just, like, bristling with every bit of information I had about, oh, at this point, they moved the curfew from 8 p.m. to 7 p.m., and then they changed the number of calories that were allocated to 14 to 18-year-olds. You know what I mean? So, like, the whole book. And my husband, my spouse, who's, like, one of my trusted readers, he read it, and he goes, he said, wow, you've never shown me something so early in the process before. So I had to, like, and I had done it in the third person, and so like I had to rewrite the whole, you know, I kind of redid the whole thing. But at that point, I knew all the characters, and I knew what the basic plot was, and I just had to rewrite it in the first person from Mano's point of view, and, like, only put in information that was necessary to moving the plot forward, kind of, you know? But I wish I were the kind of person who could think it all through first and then write it, but I do a lot of my thinking through the drafting process. So this novel went through 4 or 5 drafts.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Actually, thank you very much. Really fascinating talk, and I really look forward to reading the book. My question is somewhat historical. As you know, you mentioned Librairie Samoyen.
Yeah.
I believe Rand Samuel was already in Paris in the 1920s.
Yes, he was.
I believe the bookstore started in the 20s as well. I'm wondering if he figures in any way into this novel in some kind of disguise, or B, if in reality, in history, he actually knew Manouchian, or if you know anything on their relationship they had in.
That I don't actually know. I don't know. You know, that would probably be a question you could still ask, because the bookstore founder's children are still alive, and they might know. But that I don't actually know. I went and interviewed. There was an Armenian newspaper which was continuously in publication from the 20s until not that long ago. It's these publications called Haraj, and I went and met with the editor, you know, the publisher, who was the daughter of the founder. I'm blanking her name right now.
Arpi
Musakin, thank you. And I met with her, and she told, which was, I thought was really interesting, was that her father, rather than submit the newspaper to the censors, had ceased publication during the occupation because he didn't want it. Have the German censors, you know, have to check everything before he publishes, so he just stopped publishing. So I talked to a ton of people, like I showed you a couple of photos of people I talked to. I also talked to a woman whose father was a shoemaker in Belleville. She was 7 years old when the Germans marched down the Rue de Belleville, and her family actually took in one of her a couple of years into the occupation, like 2 years later when she was like nine, took in one of her schoolmates, who was a little Jewish girl whose family was deported. And it was very funny. It's always funny when you talk to people about what they remember. I said, well, what happened to her? And she said, I don't know what happened to her. She stayed with us for a while and then she left. I don't know what happened to her. So I end up doing this thing where I take these little bits of narrative that people give you, and I ended up, so there's a scene in the book where the neighbors are, Maral across the hall neighbors, it's a Jewish family, and the parents are taken at during the Velvet Bear Roundup, and Maral's family takes the four-year-old kid in, and they keep her until they can figure out how to get her, you know, to the southern zone, to where her aunt is. So I used that, and then when I was there, and all the people, my fixer was saying, there's this guy we want you to meet. There's this guy we want to tell you your story, but he won't agree to meet you. So they kept calling him, and finally, it was the day before I was leaving. They said he'll talk to you, but he said you can't bring a notebook and you can't bring a tape recorder. So I went, and he's a rug dealer in Paris, and I went to his rug shop and sat down with him, and he told me his whole, like, this long, crazy story. And the reason he didn't want me to have a tape recorder and he didn't want me to have a notebook was because he was planning to write his own autobiography, and so that was why he didn't want me to be able to write it down. But I think he must have been ambivalent, because if you really didn't want anyone to know the story, you wouldn't have told me the story, right? So when he told me the long story, and he was one of these guys who had been in the Soviet Army, captured by the Germans, put in the POW camp, and he said he calculated how many calories they were getting fed every day, and realized that he could last for 18 months in the camp, and he had been there for 12 months, and then this nationalist Armenian general came to the camp, and they called all the Armenians together, and he gave them the speech, and said if you put on a German uniform, and so he put the German uniform on. So he told me his whole story, like the whole thing. He had the German uniform on. He goes to France. He's building the wall on the Atlantic coast. He goes to, you know, then, and I ended up, well, then he tells me, so then the Allies invaded at a different location, not where they had built the wall. So then the Germans put them on trains, and we're going to send them to Germany to work in a munitions factory. But by this point in 1944, working in a German munitions factory, it's not such a great idea because those factories are being bombed by the Allies, right? So he and his friends decided, well, they were crossing the Belgian border and the Allies bombed the train. And he and his friends jumped out the back of the train and ran into the woods and looked for the resistance guys, found them and said, can we join the resistance? But, you know, they said, well, they took them in a can, another POW camp, so we have to contact De Gaulle and find out what to do. De Gaulle had to contact Stalin. Of course, with Stalin, if you were captured on the battlefield, you were already a traitor. You should have died on the battlefield. If they put you in a POW camp, you were already a traitor. Now think, not only were you captured and put in a POW camp, then you put the German uniform on, right? So Stalin said, no, you have to keep them. So they kept them in the POW camp at the end of the war. They sent them, they thought they were going back to Yerevan, but actually the train just kept going to Siberia. Those guys ended up in Siberia. But the guy that I met had escaped from the POW camp and managed to stay in France. So he told me the story, and he was just sitting there. I was sitting there going, he's just insanely good, right? So I finished talking with him. I ran, like, down the street, maybe, like, you know, around the corner so he couldn't see me, and I sat down in a cafe and, like, wrote the whole thing down. And then I ended up using it. And I have to say, when I finished the book, when the book was published, I sent copies of it to all the people I had interviewed, you know, thanking them for their interview. Here's a copy of the book. And I didn't send it to him because I was worried he would be, like, super pissed off that I had used his story in the book. So finally, I thought, you know, you've got to send it to the guy. So I mailed it to him with my card, and he called me, and he didn't even remember who I was. Because it was 10 years between when I interviewed him and when the book was published, and I explained to him who I was and what it was, and he was like, oh, okay, that's fine. He was fine. So anyway, so no autobiography. What?
No autobiography.
And he hasn't written an autobiography, but you know, it could have also been because that was like at the end of the war, everybody, at the end of the occupation, everybody claimed they had been in the French Resistance. Everyone in France had been in the French Resistance. You know, so to admit that you were actually in a German uniform, you know, you probably don't want that, like, story, like, circulating around after the war. And he probably felt a little embarrassed about it even, you know, years later. But I thought that was totally fascinating. So, I don't even remember what your question was. Did I answer your question? I was like, on this huge list. Yeah.
Did you have interpreters? What language were you speaking when you were...
Yeah, unfortunately, my Armenian is not very good. I studied French literature at university, and I spent a year at the University of Paris after I graduated from college. So I did the interviews in French.
You must have had good interpreters. You had good interpreters.
Interpreters? What do you mean?
Well, you're using the people who know the other language and the...
No, I would. All the Armenians spoke to me in French because they had been living in France for decades, so they all spoke French.
Can I ask another question? The trilogy quartet appears to me to be an oblique attempt at dealing with the genocide. I'm wondering if that's because you think the genocide itself, in and of itself, is beyond the realm of representation, as some philosophers and writers, including Zabel Yossayan, have claimed?
Yeah.
Or is it...
I have, you know, in Zabel, in the first novel, I have a chapter which is the narrative of the deportation, where the Kara Zabel tells the story of what happened to her family as she remembers it as a child. So I don't know if I would say that it's beyond representation. I don't know. I mean, because it's like that Martha Gellhorn quotation, war happens to people one by one. So you can certainly represent it in terms of telling the story of an individual person or even of a community, right, of what happens to that community. I don't know if it's possible to, you know, on a grand, you know, represent the entirety of it, because there were so many multiplicities of experiences that happened. So I wouldn't try to do that, but I think that you can represent individual stories, in a fictional narrative, or even, you know, people have done it in memoirs. But I think I said this to a bunch of Armenian students, or speaking to a group of Armenian students in New York, and I said, part of the thing is I feel like that Armenians in the diaspora are sort of in some ways a necrophiliac culture, that it's like really this obsession with the genocide and with the dead and with the lost and all of that. And that's not my interest. My interest is the survivors and the resiliency and the sort of vibrancy and how it is that Armenians survive and continue to make communities and to make tredeg and to make families and to make art. And, you know, so that's why this is the diaspora quartet, because I'm interested in the sort of post-genocide experience. Yeah.
You're too young to remember, but we had rationing here in the United States.
Yes.
During World War II, and the pantries of Armenian mothers were usually fuller than in peacetime. They had a way of doing that.
Yeah.
Also, Sebu's question, I would doubt very much that Samoyan would have had any relationship with this man. Samoyan was a member of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. This man is obviously a communist,
right.
And it's very unlikely that they would have had anything. And my question brings me to my question. How much of your novel deals with the life of Manoushian?
Yeah, very little.
Very little deals with the life of Manoushian.
He's sort of a peripheral character, and when they were having the show trial and the reports on the radio, the family listens to that, and they know people who know him. But it's really, this is another thing which I haven't always articulated, but I think of myself as a feminist, And I'm also very interested in women's lives and women's stories. And I didn't want it to be a heroic narrative of, you know, the resistance and we're running around blowing things up and assassinating people. It was like, how does an ordinary Armenian girl, you know, live the war? That's why I finished it. This is how we live the war and how I found my husband.
Yeah, I guess what I know is how was an Armenian orphan boy from Lebanon, what brings him into the communist movement? Have you looked at that at all, how he became Marxist communist?
But that was the interesting thing to me was that Armenians sort of ran, you know, in the experience of during the occupation, there were Armenian communists who were in the International Communist Party. There were Armenians that Nazareth Pashtikyan was a Hunshak, and so that was the Armenian communist. He was doing that. Then there were the ARF guys, and which is the Dashnak Party, which they had a whole variety of different things that they did. The Dashnaks from some kinds of horrible collaboration to, you know, staying neutral to even, you know, being, you know, on the side of the resistance. So there was that whole, you know, so all the Armenians, there was a whole spectrum of people and what their political affiliations were and what they did during the war.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I feel guilty asking too many questions.
Okay.
And the historian, I'm wondering, you mentioned Manoushian was a poet.
Yes.
Am I mistaken?
No, he was a poet.
So have you
and he was also an editor of a poetry magazine.
Do we have any remnants of any of his writings?
Yes.
Have you looked at them and can you tell us something about
I can't because he was not my main focus. I would say that my interest in him was what got me to have an interest in the period and in the community, but I did not make an exhaustive study of his life.
Gedikian's film, Gagmeditrin, is that something that...
That came out after I had finished... Yeah, but that, Gagmeditrin, the story of Manisha.
Yes.
Yeah. And the story of that resistance network and what happened. So, but that was a you know, my project was different. I was really trying to do this girl grown from the age of 14 to 20 and what her experience was there in New York. So, I could take one last question and then I'll read Proverbs. Does anybody else have a question? Yeah.
I'm going to go back to the quartet.
Okay.
And your that topic. I know you're sort of saying your answer to Ollie's question, for instance, was that it wasn't pre-planned. Nevertheless, if there seems to be a gravitation toward the post-genocide diaspora and even a commitment for consecutive novels and this that were produced under this light, I'm wondering how then that informs the way you position yourself as an Armenian American writer in the realm of world literature. I'm sort of getting at what you see art's role is, or is this guided by some sort of notion that art has a role to play with regard to representation, that it's not representing the genocide necessarily, but you're attempting to give voice to certain...
Right.
I
would say that... I think there's this line from Toni Morrison, I hope you're going to get it, right, where she says, if there's a book that you've been wanting to read and it hasn't been written, then you should write it. And so it's this idea, and then there's this great Arundhati Roy quote, which is, there's no such thing as the voiceless, only the silence and the deliberately unheard, or something. So my idea was, I wanted to tell, and there's another quote which is inspiring to me, Marina Tsvetaeva, the Russian poet, who said something like, if there's a book that you want on your own shelf and it's not there, then you must write it. So it's the same kind of thing. So I'm interested in these women's lives, like my grandmother's life and the life of this character that I have, you know, in Paris during the war years, and now the new character that I'm working on who's born in Lebanon, you know, and coming and growing up during the civil war in Beirut. And I would say because I grew up in the Armenian community, even though I live my life with sort of one foot in the community and one foot out of the community, that my imagination tends to reside there because that's where I grew up. So, but I don't, I don't feel like it's like explicitly politically engaged, but I think like as a feminist and as an Armenian that just goes with the territory. So now I'm going to read my Armenian proverbs, a few Armenian proverbs, and you'll know it's the last one because there's a cow in it. So when you hear the cow, that's the end. Land of Armenians, land of stones. Land of Armenians, land of orphans. It's better to go into captivity with the whole village than to go to a wedding alone. It's better to carry stones with a wise man than to eat pilaf with a fool. Measure 7 times, cut 1. At the bazaar, along with the goods, they also sell souls. The hungry dream of bread, the thirsty of water. The thorns of the guilty are on their mattresses. No one will give a poor man bread, but everyone will give him advice. Let's sit crooked and talk straight. The rich will have iced water even in hell. How could the snow know that the poor have no firewood? Law is written for the rich, punishment for the poor. The mind is long, life is short. What does the donkey know of the almonds? And this one isn't written here, but I have to say because I love it so much. If they send 2 baskets of shit to our city, 1 will come to our house. Be neither sweet and swallowed, nor sour and spurned. Throw your good deeds into the sea, and the waves will bring them back to you. The apricot falls under its own tree. Every raisin has a stem. Wish 1 cow for your neighbor, so God will give you 2. That's it.